This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
This program contains themes of an adult nature. Word for Word is an in-depth look into the lives of real people, which means this episode may contain explicit accounts of real-life events, including alcohol and drug use. The language used at times may cause some offence, but has been left uncensored due to the accuracy of the story. No offence is intended, and we hope you enjoy the program.
Across Australia on the Community Radio Network to over 70 community stations around the nation. This is Word for Word, coming to you from Australia's LGBTI radio station, Joy.
Welcome family and friends, fans and fiends to the 11th edition of Word for Word. I want to thank you for tuning in today. My name's Benjamin Norris and this is a 16-week series where we're getting to know Australia's LGBTI influencers. Each week, we will sit down with those who have inspired us, entertained us, but mostly they've made an impact on the queer community. Today, our guest is the Queen of Melbourne Drag. She has been seen at every gay nightclub and cabaret theatre in the tri-state area. You may have seen her in the show Boylesque as the madam in charge of some seriously talented dancers, I have to say. There isn't a night in Melbourne where you probably haven't seen this fabulous lady hosting. With the star appeal that matches a Hollywood icon and a drag aesthetic which has inspired a generation, from red carpet to hanging out with A-list Melbourne stars, I would like to welcome you and welcome Paris Drag Queen to Word for Word.
Benjamin, what a lovely introduction. Thank you so much. And I do hope I live up those pre-expectations there. Big rap. The word Hollywood just sort of had me all a quiver there. So thank you, and thank you, Joy FM.
Absolutely. You know, when I was talking about working on this show, you were the name that kept coming up. I remember watching Boylesque, I think the first night that it opened, and thinking, screw sure. And it was an ability to prove something to a Melbourne audience at the time, which was that drag isn't just about paying for yourself to go to the club and you get a gift with purchase being that drag queens are there. People were paying money and people were paying money to see you, which I think is a real achievement when you look at the drag scene around the world, because a lot of the time we do think that just comes with the program. What was it like being asked to work on that show?
Benjamin, that was certainly for myself a moment of highlight. I've got to say, you know, I've been in the game for 30-odd years now and I've enjoyed every show and every... There hasn't been a performance I could really say that I would love to erase. In fact, for that matter, there hasn't been a day of my career or being part of the community as a gay man or as a drag performer that I've wanted to erase, but certainly I would love to highlight some, and Boylesque was one. We were very fortunate enough with the opening, the revamp of the GH Hotel, to be given the first big international space. And it was international. I've been fortunate over the years. I've been able to work with some celebrity drags in numerous countries, you know. And I really do believe that the venue itself, the GH, and the cast that I was fortunate enough to work with, the backstage, the management, all were just absolutely that of an international standard. It was a wonderful time. And, yes, it's drag can mean a thousand things, and it's a very, very old term. I think I believe it sort of really was sort of first mentioned back in the Shakespearean theatrical times, back in the late 15, you know, early 1600s, and it was to do with long gowns, long flowing dresses, which took up female form, and quite often there was a shortage of female performers, and they'd put young male actors into the dresses. Therefore, they were wearing the drag, and that was the word, the term drag being used. And then under the Cromwell suppression and everything that was sort of good fun and colour and movement and gay was, you know, sort of downtrodden, it disappeared right back and, oh, for many hundred years up until the vaudevillian times, late 1800s, where it actually appeared again as the drag. What's your drag tonight? What drag are you doing? What garb are you putting on? And that was a vaudevillian term in reference to what look are you doing? Are you doing a black and white minstrel? Are you doing a vagabond or what have you? And So drag is about the character, the performer pursuing a character and a persona and getting it out there. And so drag is, yes, it's not just the girls getting out there twirling around doing a Kylie Minogue or a Shirley Bassey. It's about somebody bringing on a persona, putting a look on, and running with it.
Well, we're going to talk about the origins of you. Looking at what you were like in Sydney when you were growing up, what were you like as a child?
Look, I've always been quite flamboyant. I think there's always been that little sort of effeminate side there, and also a lover of performing and, yeah, getting the drag on. I remember as I was six years of age, standing on the stereo box. It was the record player came in this big sort of box, this big teak box, and the speakers are as large as the record player itself. And I remember standing on top of a speaker box as clear, and I was at the age of six, and cousins had not been long back from Fiji, because it's where you went when you got married. You went to Fiji for your honeymoon. And they brought back these carved wooden swords and grass skirts, and the grass skirts were sort of for my cousins, the girls cousins, and there was swords for myself and da-da. I remember doing a bit of a swap over and finishing up with one of the grass skirts and standing on a speaker box and making the family sit down in the lounge room, and I performed a song called Sweetheart Aloha at the age of six. I'd say it would be my first drag performance. So it's always been there.
I mean, that's where you probably got a taste for it.
Yes, without a doubt. I think the week later, it was probably a year or two later, again, a movie. I remember watching the production of Marie Antoinette with Norman Shearer. And blown away by it, the sparkle and the spangle and the grandeur. And we were in Sydney at this time, staying at my auntie's, and they had the big old eiderdowns, the quilts at that time. And I remember getting one and putting a belt on, and I had this big sort of billowing skirt, and I was running around the place, you know, thinking I was Marie Antoinette. And I'm sure I wasn't a lot older than six then either. So it's been a deep-rooted passion without a doubt, yes.
And what was your relationship like with your parents? What are they thinking of all of this?
Very, very lucky that my parents were just accepting. And I think at the end of the day, it takes some time, but I think at the end of the day, parents, I will stand back and go, as long as my kid's happy and healthy, they are deep down inside. Other parents, I'm not going to say my parents ran up and embraced it, you know, and cheered on the whole sort of, you know, Marie Antoinette, Norman Shearer sort of impersonation, but they certainly didn't put a stop to anything that I was wanting to do or striving to do with myself. So I'm very chosen in that respect, and there's a lot that aren't.
What attributes did you take from your parents? If you're looking at your parents and you're thinking, you know, this reminds me of that.
Tricky one. I love my parents both, and they are absolute chalk and cheese. My mother was a single child and very much a pampered lifestyle. My father was the only son of six, the second youngest, so hence a lot of older sisters, and in the good old day, the prodigal son. So he also was relatively nurtured. I think he got a lot that his sisters didn't. He was a very clever man. So his father was a hard-working chap. My grandfather put him through early school, and then he was lucky enough to pick up on some scholarships that took him right through sort of school and university for quite a few years. I think a lot of that, the fact that he was exposed to a big, bright, grand world, I think may have also helped open that my father's mind up to other ways of life. My grandfather, my mother's father, he actually was an organ player and a pianist, and he worked in showbiz very early. One of the first shows, I Pick a Box with Bob and Dolly Dyer, and he was the organist at the opening of the Sydney Opera House and what have you. So he would have no doubt been surrounded continually, as was my mother when she was a young girl, you know, by these extravagant, flamboyant men that we, you know, now call homosexuals. Back then they were just uncles. You know, my mother had a lot of uncles. And, so I think it was always a little bit of a part of their world without it sort of being out there as such.
Are there elements of your parents that you use in any way for your performance?
No, I can't say. I can't say that I do. I'm based on musicals, old school musicals and vintage style. Peers that I started doing drag with have been a very big influence on my character. Rita LaCocketa, a Melbourne drag queen, and we've been mates. We sort of did our first night together, and we've been mates for 30 years. And without a doubt, Rita's been a very big influence on who I am today. It's the whole sort of zig and zag of drag, so to speak. And yes, movies and particular styles, fashion styles, very much intrigued with the 40s and 50s, always have been. Again, going back to my family, my father's sisters, they were all in the rag trade. They all dealt in second-hand clothing. I was going to say vintage clothing, but at the time it was just second-hand clothes, and they all had stalls at Victoria Market. And they would trucks would arrive literally every week or two, and they would just unload, backload trucks, truck, and fabric clothing would come off by the ton, and all the sisters would go through, sort, because one would do coats and jackets, and one would do suits, and one would do ladies' blouses and blah. So they used to sort through. They all had their own stores in their areas. And I had cousins that were older, and they were certainly onto it then. And this is like back late 60s, early 70s, and right through when there was the Sgt. Pepper's move. And so vintage fashion was quite the article to have. And I think a lot of my passion for it actually would have started to grow and strengthen from those days, yes, without a doubt.
Did you have siblings when you were growing up?
Yes. I've got three brothers. There was myself, another brother, an older brother, and then there's quite a few years gap between the younger two. And
how many brothers do you have?
Well, three three boys and a lady boy, so to speak. The younger two brothers, actually, it was really good fun when they hit the age where they'd sort of discovered, you know, the bright lights and everything that goes with it. They're not gay guys at all. Now sort of wives, kids, the whole scenario, mortgage and the whole living the Aussie dream. But when they started going out, it was really good fun, actually, because there was still the gay zone was still not really quite the go zone for anybody who wasn't part of the community, where they just jumped on board and vice versa. You know, we'd sort of finish up at our clubs, our gay clubs, and all of a sudden we'd finish up in a car with, you know, my brothers and their mates, and we'd finish up at some bloody, you know, oh, the Red Eagle pub back in Richmond or whatever it may have been. So it was a really good crossover of both the worlds, and having the backstop of my brothers there to be able to do that, which was a wonderful thing.
And isn't that beautiful that you had that relationship with them?
Yes, yeah, very lucky. Once again, so blessed with my childhood, having the acceptance of my parents and then the siblings coming through. Even today, one particular sister-in-law, Carol, is just sort of right onto the social media and who kids are, and there's really not a photo that doesn't go by that's not commented on, or, you know, given a little love or a thumbs up or whatever it may be.
It's all acceptance.
It is acceptance, yes, it is, and it's a wonderful thing. And these kids are very, very fortunate because their parents are in that mindset, and you meet so many people that are just so open and accommodating. And I look at them and I think, God bless you for being who you are, but more to the point, God bless your kids for you allowing them to be the next generation.
Because I'm just absolutely fascinated by, I think, the privilege. Did you have any dynamics within your brothers? Like, is there a role that you kind of played?
It was really about me most of the time. It really was. I mean, why shouldn't it be,
never,
Benjamin? Why shouldn't it be?
Well, I think it's great, though, because in some ways, you know, this is the one thing that I'm picking up from that, is that, you know, for them to allow you to do that is a generous and empathetic nature, you know, which is obviously, these are the things that your parents, these are the values that your parents obviously laid out for you. You know, I don't necessarily get the impression from you that they necessarily verbalised that. I think they taught that by their own behaviour.
I think you've pretty much summed it up there, yes. And when I say sport, we were very sport in the respect that we were never denied. We were never denied being who we wanted to be, provided we never would show any disrespect or cause any harm towards anyone or anything else. We were always allowed to be who we wanted to be and express that.
I get the chills, Paris, when you say that, because this is a philosophy that more people these days need to take on board, and yet your parents were doing that so many years ago. And I think that that's a really, the reason why I get the chills for that is because wouldn't it be amazing if we all had those philosophies?
Wonderful. Maybe, Benjamin, maybe I mentioned before how I look at people today with children growing up and their attitude towards them, and them wanting to be not sheltering of alternative lifestyles and subcultures. And isn't it incredible, after all these years and this conversation I've had before, the nail's just actually been hit on the head. My parents were those people that I admire and look at today with a great deal of, yes, admiration. And yes, so my parents were exactly the people that I look at and I go, my God, what wonderful people you are, what wonderful parents you are.
Yeah.
My parents, yes, obviously may have, well, they were.
There's no words in so many ways, but you just want to take your hat off to these people and say, you know, well done. So then I guess, you know, as you'd gone through school and then you're sort of coming into your young adult life, how old were you when you started to work out your sexuality?
Teenage and young teen years, it wasn't a sex-driven thing. The whole, you know, becoming Paris, it was more about being able to, you know, find the garb to wear and where are we going to go this Saturday night? And will we drink a, you know, Harvey Wallbanger, or can we only afford to have a white wine, orange juice and a splash of raspberry? It was more about that. Once again,
would you say that people knew your sexuality before you did then?
I'd pretty much say so. I think when you're six, you know, doing Sweetheart Hello, you know, on a stereo box in a grass skirt, I think they would have picked up there and then that this one's not, you know, not the full box of chocolates, as I would have said back in the day. But, yeah, it was never questioned, never discussed. The very, very first conversation and the only conversation really ever that has come to a head with my family, I was getting in the car. We were going to, I was going to Sydney for Mardi Gras with a very dear friend of mine, Henry, and my mother always would be the sort of mama, I'll come for the drive. Anyway, my father's in the car, I've got my gear, I've got out to the car and I've got in the back seat. And my father said, look, get in the front, jump in the front. And I said, oh, what about mum? He said, oh, she's not coming. And I said, oh, how very strange for my mother not to come for a drive. And we're driving out and we're just having a bit of a chat or whatever. And my father said, now, look, I know you're going for the weekend and I know you're up there to have a party and you're going to be with Henry, you're going to have a ball and you're going to do this. But, you know, I just really want you to be careful. You've got to be safe. And, like, you really got to think about what you're doing and just have a fun, safe party. He just really couldn't come out and say it. But it was very much, you know, around the time we had the big AIDS campaign ads and the Grim Reaper and all of that. So they were having the message sort of driven home hard and fast during the Don Lane show or whatever they may have been watching. He just couldn't quite come out and say, bang, you know, safe sex.
He was thinking that,
just didn't know how to go about it. I suppose his approach to it wasn't as the death knell as it would have been on the commercials. But then again, the commercials at the time, the campaign at the time, they weren't really worded in a way that it wasn't a subject to bring up. It was more a drive home of, my God, this is going to happen if you have a root with a gay man. It was more a fear. And, of course, I don't think a father wants to speak to their kids, you know, with that sound of fear in their voice or show the sound of fear in their voice.
Yeah.
So I think it was very hard for people to find the terminology and the approach.
What an era to grow up in, though. How did that affect you?
Look, it certainly has had and still no doubt has an effect on myself. You know, very sad times. And lost a lot of friends, you know. And it was funny, quite often too, it wasn't just addressed as, I have got HIV. You know, some of your dearest, dearest, closest friends would be like, oh, I've got this problem or I've got this rash or I've got a cancer or whatever. It's like, rather than just coming out and saying, look, you know, I've contracted HIV, bang. It actually took the loss of quite a few friends before people really started coming up and sort of saying, listen, do you know what, parents, bad news here. I've just got results back and this is the case.
It's one of those things where, like, you never really get over that sort of stuff. You know, it does make an impact. And I think that's probably why your stories are so interesting to me, because there's some real emotion behind who you are. But then to be a survivor through that, there's some real character behind who you are. There's nothing fake about it. You know?
No. So, look, it hasn't been a dress rehearsal by any means. You know, everyone's just had to get on getting on. And even to this day, we all have sad days, you know, shocking days and upsets. And we lose loved ones for different reasons. And I say it, and maybe I say it at the wrong time. I say, look, life is for the living and, you know, get on with getting on. That is certainly by no means, lest we forget. And I never forget or never a day goes by I don't sort of think of my dear ones that aren't with us now.
It's the things that we don't talk about.
Yes.
And
yes.
What you're talking about now and what you're demonstrating here, even with even sharing these stories, is resilience. You know, there's a huge amount of resilience and empathy happening for you to be this person.
Yeah, Benjamin, I think that's probably, look, your terminology is there. You've sort of got me off on a bit of a path here. Yeah, I wasn't really expecting. I was sort of expecting, we'll talk about colour and movement and sequins and big hair. But
well,
no,
we
that's,
will.
That, we will. But that's, you know. There's more to life than smoke and mirrors. You're sort of certainly getting the terminology out there to possibly express what I'm trying to say. But yes, it does makes you resilient. With that, don't be scared to have a little cry, because if you don't cry, you will go mad.
I'm an emotional nightmare that. Because, like, I have to try so hard because I think I tap into emotion with people.
Yes.
What I want to ask you, though, is if you had the opportunity to be able to give yourself as a child some advice. So, little Paris, now that you know what you know, what advice would you give?
That I am not going to sleep another day away. You know, too much time for that when you're gone. And that's possibly one thing I would have said to myself, you know, young Paris, saying to where I am now. Don't crawl into the hole. Don't get into the fetal position. Don't pull that doona up because it's too tough to get out. Get up and get your show on the road. And I've learned that. I've learned that in the last, you know, 15 years or so, 10 years, and then had a good old shake-up again in the last couple of years about it. And I've just got to keep reminding myself of that. Get out and get on with it.
People would never know that about you. You know, for the people that are out and about, and I guess your close friends who have the privilege of being in your company in your own home, they'd see it. But for the average punter that sees you out looking fabulous, they would never know that.
No, look, I think it's certainly becoming a topic now that is much more open.
As it should be.
It is. As you said, Benjamin, it's how it should be.
We're unassuming. It's not like you get a letter in the mail that says, oh, you've got anxiety, and it can happen to any of us. Like, it's like a dark cloud that will come in and it can go. But it's about, I think we're getting to a place now, which I really love, is that we're talking about it more, which means we're acknowledging people more.
Definitely, definitely. And it does need to be, it does need to be discussed. It's something that is not just like talk to a buddy about it and have a beer, it'll be right in the morning. I think we really do need to look at support groups and then access to what's ever required to help the person get on with living and get out of bed, whether it be medication, whether it be sort of, psychiatrist, psychologist, just say, here I am still fucking holding back on using those two words. It's
ridiculous.
And
there's no shame in it.
No, there's none at all. If you've got to go and speak to somebody, you know, great, go and see your man. I'll go and see my man, Richard, but, you know, go and see a psychiatrist. I think we just need to have a bit more support, a bit more understanding of people's fear.
Well, we have the tools in society for so many things. You know, we've got the tools in society these days to organise a date for you.
Yes.
You know, why wouldn't you use the tools in society to help you through a mental illness? Look, I think there's been some dark times definitely in anybody's life, but if we look back at your life, what do you feel proud of the most?
I think I, goodness gracious, not being humble here, it's not a humble moment, you know, sort of, I'm proud of where I've sort of, where I started my drag, and I'm proud of where I've actually maintained it. I don't believe I've got, I haven't, yes, I don't believe I've got lazy. I don't think I've fallen into the off the shelf, it'll be right, throw this on, it's great, riding on my own coattails. I'd like to think that I've kept working at my character and my career.
I believe there's a lot of thought in everything that you do. That's what's kept you in this industry for so long.
Yes, I believe it is. I think so, Benjamin. I think it's not, look, I'm not going to kid myself. I'm not a singer. I'm not a dancer. I've just got to look and I talk to people. I know that that is the base of my longevity. It's thinking about what I'm going to do, what I'm going to wear, how I'm going to execute myself, and then saying hello. And you can walk up to anybody and they'll know you and you know them. And you get on stage, you can do a bloody bust-ass number, but they're like, yeah, Paris, it's my girlfriend, yeah. It's my girlfriend. They love it. They love it. No one's sort of really totally aware of how bad the performance was. But, you know, you're the girlfriend and you get a clap. And I think that's been a very big part of certainly the length of my career, without a doubt.
There's a real art form, and I think it's protecting that art form, which is important. What study did you make after high school? Is there something that you studied, or what helped you with this?
I couldn't get out of school quick enough, actually. It was like, oh, thank God, you know. I was into high school and then never went back. Went and spent time with one of my greatest passions, which was horses, equestrian sports and riding, and spent a number of years when I first left school living with a family out on the other side of town. Just that love of vintage clothing and fashion and the look, I'm sure stems from my childhood, stems from my love of old movies, musicals, period movies, documentaries. Whatever I do or whatever look I'll sort of go for certainly is without a doubt it's a mimic of something that has been done very, very well before. I'll pull on that or pull elements of styles, interpretations of and put together. You know, you hear so much of, oh, she stole my look, she stole my number. I mean, for Christ's sakes, girls, have a look around. No one's stolen anything. It hasn't been stolen before that. It's just about, you know.
It is a very competitive land. Can you tell me about the name Paris? How did that come about?
My mother, when you think about it, she's got a lot to answer for, actually, came up with Paris, and it was not a drag thing. And when we first started doing drag, going out with friends, and it was like around the time there was a lot of androgyny happening, and the clubs, like the club look was, well, you could sort of be punk or you'd be androgy or you'd be, you know, a mod or whatever you wanted to do. And we were very much, of course, down the androgynous look, and Marilyn and Boy George and Pete Burns were all the rage, and we were all sort of picking up on that. So it was nothing for us to go out with a full face of makeup on, but then an old silk smoking jacket from an op shop or what have you. And so it was that very, very fine line between the caricature female impersonation and then that androgynous look. It was, they were both two types of drag. And very, very first night I went out in drag was with Rita, I think I mentioned. And we did a, it was a 60s party. We went a 60s theme. And I went as Jackie Onassis. And I just sort of wanted to be Jackie O, Jackie O, Jackie O. Of course, got to a party. And I think we may have kicked onto a club after that. And then friends, of course, being the first night out, they're not sort of turning around and all of a sudden just calling you Jackie because you said, I'm Jackie for the night. You know, you're still Paris. So people then sort of just pick up on Paris, Paris, Paris. And being the name that it is, it could be very easily mistaken as somebody assuming that was the name that you've actually dubbed yourself for drag. Paris, I tried for Jackie for a little while there, but it sort of didn't kick in. So Paris has remained, and no surnames. People say, have you got a surname? It's like, no, God dang it, 4 a.m. in the morning, I'm flat out remembering my first name, let alone a surname. Give me some help here.
I don't think you need a surname because, like, Madonna doesn't need one.
No.
If you're going out of the club scene in Melbourne and you want to know what's the show, people go, well, Paris is going to be there. I mean, you might get Paris the drag queen, but the drag queen is not a surname.
No, no, and that's only something that's popped up with social media, you know, like that whole having to have that sort of surname thing when that all came in there, Facebook and so, you know, you get Paris drag queen or Paris DQ or whatever, which is fun, actually. It does give you a bit of a title if you want one, you know, sort of throw that on. Otherwise, yeah, no, just Paris through thick and thin.
Well, I think what's interesting is that, you know, certain people have a certain amount of notoriety and they are famous in certain circles. And I certainly think, you know, for me, in my circle, you know, Paris is famous. Did you ever think that you could be this notorious?
No, Benjamin, no. Look, not in our wildest dreams. We were just very much, when I say we, myself and my crew, that, you know, we sort of started kicking around with... we're in the right place at the right time. And Gavin Brown, Hot Coco, had a big club here at the time. Miss Candy was headlining, and Kerry Lagore was sort of big in town. And we were there, right place, right time. Got asked to one club, got asked to the next, all in a matter of weeks. Next thing it was happening. Next thing we had, you know, you come and pick us up with some ridiculous headdresses we'd made, and and we're on stage on a New Year's Eve, and the rest is history.
Can you remember that first gig?
I can remember it very well. I do. I do remember it.
I want to know. You have to tell me.
Oh, goodness gracious. It was called Beehives in Space. And it was at the Cadillac Bar. Myself, Red Le Coq Eater, Gavin Brown, Hot Coco. It was also the very first... that show was also the very first performance of our dear, late, great Vivian St. James.
Wow.
Performed that night as well for the very first time. So it was quite a milestone evening. I remember it very well, Beehives in Space. And I think it was all directed, produced and sort of sung out loud by Rita, as she does, and she does very well. And I did Interplanetary Craft by the Carpenters, and I went into Barbarella and all sorts. But, yeah, I remember it very well, actually. And there was a couple more gigs after that. And then I think it was the New Year's Eve of 1986 into 1987 that we were there with Gavin Brown. I sort of... Hot Coco. So I sort of put down that was sort of pretty much the start of it all from then. And it has been a whirlwind tour, I've got to say. It's sort of had us here, there and everywhere, man. It's met some incredible people. I know for a fact that I wouldn't have been, you know, in most of the situations and would have met the people that I've met had it have not been for the drag element persona. It's certainly been an incredible ride, and it's not over yet, you young bitches. If you're sort of starting to think she sounds like she's hanging her heels, no, I'll keep going as long as I'm wanted.
Well, this is the real life RuPaul's Drag Race in the sense that, you know, you're still in the game.
Yes, true, true.
And
true,
it ain't true. Over.
No, it ain't over. No,
and, you know, there's plenty more parties to go to, and I think the most important thing for you is there's plenty more drags and training wheels that are coming up that are going to learn from you.
if not learn the right things, certainly don't learn the wrong things. But there's a lot of fabulous talent coming through, a lot of fabulous talent, and I've said it all along. I think a couple of decades back, Sydney Drag was awesome. It was phenomenal to watch. It was sharp. It was dancey. It was a very, very good combination of everything that we have in Melbourne now, but just sort of all pieced together. It wasn't just dance-driven. It wasn't just like wearing the bare minimal or wearing the excessive. It was a really good combination of all. But Melbourne has always had very much a strong culture and a great culture, and I've made this comment, and I've made it many times, and I'll make it again, and I stand by it. Been fortunate enough to have travelled around and seen quite a bit of drag and work with a lot of drag, including the likes of RuPaul, and I don't think that we have any better than what we do in Melbourne. I think our Melbourne drag, and this is not being the big patriot by any means, I think Melbourne drag is the best drag that I personally have seen worldwide, and that's over a couple of decades too. That's just sort of not currently speaking. That's sort of over the past.
That's amazing to hear that from you.
20 odd 30 years of travelling and watching drag, I would always come home and go, God, our drag's good. And that's not being a Melbourne queen. I just sort of would say that regardless of where I was from.
Who do you think is the queen of the crop right now?
I've always said that I think the most talented drag I've seen, and I keep mentioning her name and it loathes me to do so, Red La Cocketa could arrive anywhere in the world. Her suitcases were not on the same plane. She would just walk into a $2 shop or go and pull a flag off a pole or whatever. She'd get a show on the road, and that is a true drag. She'll just pull down curtains in the hotel room, and I guarantee she'll put a show on and it'll be entertaining. Therefore, I think she's the best I've ever seen and the best that there is.
What about the new up-and-comers?
The new up-and-comings, there's a queen, Serotonin, who I haven't had a lot to do with, but I've just watched her, the way she handles herself, the way she talks to people. She's very gracious. She's very accommodating. She's very tangible. I think that will be the secret to her longevity if she pursues the industry. And also I've seen the versatility. I've seen her be able to get up there and, oh well, whether she has been able to or she hasn't, she's got up there and she's pushed the envelope in all different directions, which is a bloody big start. And I think she'll find out what sort of direction the envelope falls for her, and then she'll go with avant-garde, she'll go with a classic lip sync. But
it'll organically sort of be pursued.
It will develop. It will develop. She's not scared to give anything a go. She's not scared to put her head on the chopping block. And she's a good queen. So for me, I think she's certainly one that's in the new crop. I'm talking in that fresh crop.
No, I like it. I'm like,
keep watching.
She's listening. She'd probably be thinking, well, hopefully she's also crying, you know, and thinking, wow, you know, a legend has shone a light on me. What about role models? Because before you mentioned RuPaul, who do you look up to like that?
Okay, I've always sort of grew up watching more female impersonation, our showgirls. Renee Scott is a very, very strong performer and an incredibly strong human being, God rest her soul, who I just was in absolute awe of. And then after I was very fortunate enough to become to know, I'd love to say become a friend of, have a great deal of admiration for her. For her strength and her handling of situations, incredible. Another person, Deborah Legay, once again, just being able to handle a situation and handle people and then go on stage and just be spectacular. But it's that having that happy balance in that medium. And it's not just being the diva, it's being the person that goes with being the diva. Kerry Lagore, of course, God rest her soul. Look, the mother of all drags, Miss Candy, you know, has been there really from day one, and I just have to say that certainly has been, if not so much a role model, a strength, a very, very good strength. Likewise, Gavin Brown, who we're still friends with today, his creativity and his zest for life and getting right back to pushing the envelope. He was one who was just out there doing it before anybody else was in our circle. So it took a lot of courage in latter years from Gavin to push it. All right, honey, you got your heels established, now push it, rather than just sort of fall into that safety zone. So they're possibly the strong points.
To the next generation, do you find yourself giving this a similar piece of advice time and time again?
If I'm asked for it, yes, I do. I do. I always say to people, so just be nice and respect people, be happy and don't spend a fortune on things. Don't run out there. I've seen so many young queens run out there, literally hock their box to buy, you know, the latest stud on eBay or whatever it may be, and have this gown and that wig and blah, blah, blah. No, get your character first, get your sense of comfort and where you're going, and then there's room to extend all of the fluff and bubble on top of it.
It's almost asking people to believe in themselves. I mean, you don't necessarily... I think for a lot of people, if you're a little bit insecure about what you're doing, you're hoping by putting on the wig and the dress and the accessories that it'll teach you the job. But what your advice is to really start from the inside.
Yes, basically. Benjamin, that's exactly right. You know, you don't have to have the best of best wigs. Just get a wig and wear it comfortably, and that wig's going to flick as well as the expensive one is for the first couple of wears anyway. Just get comfortable with yourself and find your comfort zone. And then let people around you know that you are comfortable, and then therefore they're going to be comfortable around you, and then that's when the whole cycle starts. Then you'll sort of start, you know, dibbling out here and dabbling out there and getting the bits and pieces and getting the notoriety and the gigs that come with it and getting a buck that enables you to go and buy that.
What you want later on.
Yes, exactly.
What's missing at the moment? We've had the Greyhound go. What's missing from the gay scene at the moment?
Look, Benjamin, it's a question I get asked a lot, actually. What's happened? What's happened to town? Considering our population has grown so much and this has got bigger and, you know, the community's so much stronger and it's more open and it's more accepted and the whole equality thing is getting where we want it to get, and yet it seems the culture seems to be dwindling, and I honestly don't have any idea. I've thought about it and I've been asked by interstate friends and travellers overseas, friends, and I don't have an answer. I keep standing back, scratching my head. I've made mention that I think, you know, Melbourne has got some of the best drag in the world. So I don't think it's the lack of entertainment. We've had amazing venues. You know, we had The Market and Three Faces under Ken Payne and Spiro. And we had the GH under Will. We couldn't have asked for any more in the way of facilities. They were all there, and yet they still didn't actually answer the question. Otherwise, they would still be there. I don't know whether online dating connections, drugs, expense, socioeconomic sort of state of the country, or I don't know the answer to why.
Could be a combination of.
It's a tricky one. It's a funny one.
The scene is so a part of my culture. I think it's going to be sad in a way to not go to some of those more famous clubs and know that we're going to see some of those faces. But have you got any advice for me? Where am I going to see you? People out there listening to this
right
now.
Yeah, you'll find me around.
Where's the best drag show and where am I going to see you?
I'm not going anywhere in a hurry. I must say, I haven't been doing an awful lot of performance in the gay clubs as such. I've been having some fun at the Peel on Friday nights, and I must say that is a hoot down there with the crew. For me, it's going to the pub and having a drink, you know, with the gang. I've been thoroughly enjoying my Friday nights. Last couple of months, I've made a couple of appearances at Molly's Bar at Circuit on Smith Street, and I've really thoroughly enjoyed it. And it's interesting. It's my passion is obviously still there, and the ego is still there, obviously hungry for it. And being able to do a number, then step off stage and walk and talk and have the praise, and then speak to people like-minded or people within the community as such. That's been very fulfilling. Sunday night, Love Machine. I get down there, and there's a fabulous crew of showgirls and promoters and management there. So I'm kicking around town, honey. I'll be kicking around town. Yes.
What project would you say you enjoyed working on the most?
I loved some of the very early stuff that we did, you know, way back when. It was very raw drag, but it was also very naughty and it was edgy. When I say that, delivering it, getting it on stage, you know, getting a cab, getting to the venue, it was a pretty dangerous place. You know, you didn't sort of walk out and sort of stand on the front street and wait for the next one to drive by. You looked through the Venetian blinds. When a cab arrived, you ran to it, you locked that door on you and you ran in. You know, it was a scary place. They were all good fun shows, I think, because we were out there, you know, doing what we wanted to do. You know, it was in a no-man's land. A couple of years, it was about 2 years ago, it was on Melbourne Cup Day, I think it was, and I went down to do a gig down at the Brighton Hotel, and I wasn't aware they had a whole new sort of big back sort of area at the back reception area, which is beautiful, and I walked in the side public bar, and I walked in, full drag bag over the shoulder. A couple of people turned around, had a look, sort of the odd smile, went back to the bar watching the races on the screen. I had to push and shove to get my way through the crowd, got to the bar, stood there and wait. I mean, I had to wait at the bar, don't you know who I am, you know, for the barman to walk up and say, "Hi, mate, what do you want?" It was like, wow, what do I want, you know? I'm here and gig. But I thought about that and thought about it and thought about it for weeks. That was it, mainstream. I was just one of the punters. You know, the hell I was. I thought I looked amazing. It's 1 o'clock in the afternoon, full drag. No one batted an eyelid. 10 years before that, you would have opened the doors and you would have got the whistles and the claps and the, "Oh, can I have a photo, please, for my mum?" And da-da. Going back another 10 years prior to that, there would have been a bit of hustling. There would have been maybe a whistle. There would have been a clap, maybe. but there would have been a parting of the seas. The crowd would have pulled back and you would have gone straight to the bar. The barman would have shit himself and the manager would have run over and wanted to know what you were doing and what was going on. Can I help you there? What's going on? Prior to that, it just would have been a no-go zone. So it's funny in that over the decades how it's progressed now to where we've almost just become a, you know, as I said, punter coming in all dressed up
because it's Melbourne Cup
day, part of the furniture to have a beer and back a winner.
What do you think we're going to face now? I mean, we've just had marriage equality and obviously that is a really big milestone, but what do you think is something that we need to look at now?
I think we need to learn to carry a little bit more of an etiquette. We want to hang on to our culture and our community as such. We need to learn to present and deliver and address ourselves. I'm very sick and tired of being out and about and hearing more so younger, the younger generation, the way they're addressing people in shops, restaurants, at bars, door staff, wherever it may be. It's almost a little bit, I'm a gay boy, I'm entitled to.
Yeah.
No, honey, you're not entitled to anything. You know, you earn your entitlement. You respect somebody, you'll get the respect back. That's what you're entitled to, respect. And you'll only get that if you respect people. And at the moment, I feel like not everybody's sorry. I think a lot of the younger part of the community are really very much like, you know, we are gay, we've got to have it on a silver platter. Pig's ass. No one owes you nothing.
Do you know where we've come from?
Yeah, and I just think it's getting right back down to everybody just once again be treated like you want to be treated yourself. I think we need to learn to sort of really hang on to the elements that I love of our community. You know, the self-expression, whether it be through your dress, you know, your flamboyancy, the manner of speech, your terminology, whatever it may be, hang on to it, but learn now to be able to address it. Walk through, or be yourself in a mainstream pub or a restaurant or at the casino or whatever it may be, and not hide the fact that you are a member of LGBTI community in whatever form or creed you take on. You do that as strong and as proud as we did say 20 years ago, walking to that Brighton Hotel. But you do it now in a style and a manner that it is accepting and it's nice, and other people are going to go, ah, one of us. But yeah, obviously part of the community, that community, LGBTI community. If we're going to hang on to that title, we've got to learn to be able to carry it well.
I think that there needs to be now, and this is a theme that's come up a fair bit throughout the series, is respect for other causes as well. I mean, we did fight very hard for marriage equality. There's still more things to be fought for transgender people, for bisexual people, but then also outside of the LGBTI community.
What
we can do for other causes is more of what's outside of us.
Benjamin, certainly, I think we have, apart from what we've achieved, I think the community has got to stand back and say we have learnt so much. And like going right back to the 60s, the very early protests in New York, the Stonewall days as such, when you had all your drag queens and your flamboyant queens out there and you want to be sort of underground culture out there protesting. They're all just being picked up, locked up and dragged off at 10 at night. You know, all of a sudden some learned people got their heads and they said, you know, put a collar and tie and be clean cut. If you wear glasses, wear your glasses. If you've got patent leather shoes, put them on. Do as you do. Go as a professional. And they started doing their protests during the day. They got publicity and all of a sudden that was the big move and the big sort of stand towards gay rights as such. And that was a big learning curve for the community decades ago back then, how to address things and how to handle themselves. And I think we have learnt so much and I think we've established and achieved so much that, yes, we've got to use this power now, this knowledge, I should say, we've got to use this knowledge to help. I don't like to use the word equality, because I don't believe equality is now being used equally. It's being used as a very sort of stronghold in the LGBTI community, that we've really lost sense of what the word is about. And equality is for all, for everybody, single mothers, single fathers, minority groups of all sorts, race, religions and what have you.
Do you think the attachment of the word equality towards the queer community is probably diluted in a way what it does mean for the everyday man?
I think we're using the word too often, and I think when it gets, yes, used by just the general census, that it's, you say equality and before you go on with the second part of the sentence, or the second word for that matter, people are sort of standing forward in defence of, or in denial, or whatever it may be, or to tackle you because you've said equality they seem to automatically assume that the conversation is going to lead somewhere towards our community's rights. I really do believe that's become the case with the word equality. And if that is the case, well, let's use that word equality, but let's get it out there to cover a hell of a lot more lot more subcultures and factions that actually need equality as well. Let's use that to our power then. Let's not sort of try to turn it around, but let's use it. Let's not forget what it's all about, where it's all going to. We've got the same-sex marriage through, which has been an amazing thing, and everybody enjoy it, but the honeymoon will have to be over, and we've got to get up and get our, you know, get our heels back on, 2 feet on ground level, and get back on with the next fight. And there's plenty of fights out there that need to be handled for those that aren't sort of strong enough or in numbers enough to do it themselves, as we have been ourselves in the past. Together we are united, but there's a lot of groups, factions out there that aren't, don't have our strength and support. So let's get behind them where it's right and where it's needed and make that word become pretty much synonymous with a quality of life. I think that's what equality has to become.
Do you think that with some of our sports stars, some of our entertainers that have reluctantly held back their sexuality over the years, do you think that now that we've made some progression that we'll start to see queer people in more sporting events?
Benjamin, there's certainly been the strong ones, I'm not saying anybody that wants to throw their sexuality out there being any weaker person, but I believe that's very much for the individual. I think it's unfortunate if somebody is in a place of power and has a means to be able to act or flick a switch on to help others. When they don't flick that switch, I think that's a sad thing. However, they've got their finger on the switch, not us. We can't force them to do it. I'd love to think they'll step to the mark, but if they don't, that again is their, that's their decision, and that's their right to be able to hold that information back. And for me to be able to say I am gay and the person next door to me not to be able to comment or not to be able to throw it out there, they're entitled to that, and that is equality. They've got the equal right to be able to hold back on their sort of throwing out their sexual preference to what I have to actually airing mine. So I don't believe, I've always been very much against outing. I think it is a shame, as I said, if somebody has the power to help somebody else and sits back and let it happen, that's a shame, but then they shouldn't be forced to either.
You get to be on the red carpet and you get to rub shoulders with a lot of very famous people. Have you ever had that conversation without revealing names of a person who is reluctant to come out asking for your advice?
Yes, I have. I have actually, Benjamin. I have. Yeah, many times over the years for that matter. In saying so, many a time it's sort of been, at a party or a hotel room or an after party with a half a bottle of gin under our belts. However, I don't believe it's drunk talk. I think maybe that booze, that bit of gin, is just giving the Dutch courage to say what they've been wanting to say for quite some time. And once again, I've just sort of gone along and respected the fact that they've been in a bit of a scenario. We spoke about how lucky I was sort of growing up and how privileged with the acceptance I had with family and friends. People, I think, quite often will hold back because they don't have that same sort of safe place. So it's all very well for me to say, oh, but you should, honey, you should throw your hands in the air every time they play Kylie Minogue, you know. But there's obviously a reason why. I don't think anybody really wants to carry a chip around on their shoulder. I think everybody loves to be able to get rid of that excess luggage and just go, oh, free again.
I could be who I am.
Yes, and I know that the conversation has come up with myself. I've had people sort of say to me, you know, you're amazing, I look at you, and I just sort of think, well, great, you know, I haven't had the toughest trot in the world, you know, in getting to where I am because of the acceptance of friends, family.
And what's happened to you?
Yes, exactly. What is holding you back? And these are people that have been of they've been of their own financial means, and they've got their own, certainly, you know, voice, strength, powers from their professions or whatever they do, but there's obviously something there sort of deep-rooted that is a big ball and chain around their anchor. I have that sort of sad feel for them.
Well, I guess, you know, it's everyone's own journey. You can't expect or you can't really say this is what happened to me, so this is what's going to happen to you. But you certainly, I guess, can lend your ear and protect their truth.
Yes, and that's exactly it. Benjamin, there with that, people having that conversation with you, and I've got names and faces floating through my mind now, but I'll see them out again. And they're quite comfortable to walk up to me, Paris, the drag queen. And there they are, looking very, very, very elegant, you know, in their dress or their lady's dress, or they're looking very, very eloquent in their suit or their tuxedo. And they're still comfortable to walk up, give me a shake of the hand or a peg or, you know, a cuddle, knowing that they've had a conversation in the past. It's never been aired. It's never gone any further. So I sort of think it's lovely giving that little bit of an anchor stone there as well, that next time they can bowl on up again and not sort of feel the need to hide and run and get very, very angry with the whole kiss and tell scenario. You know, that's something that you just don't do. If people have a conversation with you, it's sort of it's a conversation with you. It's what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas, and I think it's one of the oldest rules written in the book.
One of the other things I was going to say was, interestingly enough, throughout the series, I've talked about a tipping point, and there was a real change from the way in which people in the past used to protest the sex with, like, you know, a lot of graphic imagery and things like that whenever there'd be a protest. And then it changed to, you know, talking about equal rights, equality. Why do you think it was back in the day that people felt, do you think that they felt so put upon that their rebellion was to push the sex forward? You know, well, you're making me feel excluded, so I'm going to put this in your face.
Just even, not recognition, but just for awareness, it was going to get the media. It was going to get the media. Mm. It was going to get the newspaper on board. It was going to get the Herald Sun. Of course, people were going to sit home and watch it. Unfortunately, 3/4 of the mugs that were sitting home and watching it, you know, 30-odd, 20 years ago, weren't the same mindset as a lot of people that sit down and watch it now. I think when they started the coverage of Mardi Gras, how they, you know, once again, the media would home in on some of the more graphic or more out there or whatever. They were sort of going out of their way to try to sort of source the vulgar of the sordid affairs of Mardi Gras.
Isn't that so interesting? You're the first person throughout talking about this that I really had worked that out, you know, and at the end of the day, it probably had less to do with how the community was overall wanting to be depicted and maybe more how the media was trying to push it across.
Definitely, and I had a big issue with the Mardi Gras. I did being televised because you just knew exactly who and what and how they're going to home in on. Quite often, friends of mine, they were parts. They were factions of our community, and whether they were expressing themselves through their style of love or form of dress or whatever, there are so many elements that make our community the wonderful thing that it is, and yet the media would, as I said, pick on what they would imagine to be the most sordid non-Christian type they could, and that was what the whole coverage was of.
Again, that's the same thing. They honed in on the salaciousness, the sexualness, and probably what they knew was going to create an uneasy feeling for those people out there who were full of fear.
Yes. Our big march we had, the last major big march, don't ask me for date, prior to the change in the legislation, had two very dear friends of mine and my partners. We do not have a lot of gay friends as such. We just have friends. But anyway, these particular boys were going to the march, the demonstration, the protest, whatever you, and they were going to wear, it came up in conversations. They asked, did I have an old wedding gown or whatever? They were basically going to go dressed as brides. And I said, what are you doing that for, guys? You know, you're going to take the piss out of yourselves. You're going to take the piss out of the commitment you've made to each other for so many years. What do you want to get? You don't do drag on a regular basis. Where are you coming from with wearing, both of you wearing a bride's dress? Men, you know, in white bride's gowns to this protest march. You know, what are you going to do apart from try to get on the front cover of the Herald Sun and make us look like a pack of dills fighting for?
Did they wear the dresses?
No, they didn't. They actually, and I don't know that it was actually my conversation with them. And it was a lengthy, heated conversation. I will say that, by all means. I'd call it a blue. It was a blue amongst friends. But I was very anti them doing it. They didn't quite understand why.
That's because you're conditioning them to tell their truth. I mean, that's not their truth. They're not going to get their message across if
they're not.
Actually,
no, they could make everybody else standing out there look like absolute dills by the greater community out there in the burbs. That, you know, because you know now and when who's going to home in on what the news cameras are going to go for. They're not going to look for lovely Jane and Joanne standing there walking down the street side by side, or Brian and Jeffrey in his sort of chinos and there's Jeffrey in his overalls from work. They're going to go bang right on the two boys dressed up in white wedding dresses. It's just looking to grate down the grain of those that haven't got the mindset just yet where it should be. And unfortunately, that's our media. That's the world in which we live.
Absolutely.
That's what sells, honey, doesn't it? Yes, sells the papers for them.
I guess looking back at this whole chat that we've had and looking at who you are as a person and what it is that you've been able to cultivate over the years, is there a message that you have for the queer community that is listening to this right now?
I would like everybody just to keep working away what we've done. We've achieved so much. When I say we, not just present day, but over the history of our community, not just Melbourne, but Australia-wide for that matter. Just keep doing what we do. Do it well and do it with respect, and just don't forget that we've taken one giant step for mankind, but there's a hell of a lot more steps to be taken. And the Berlin Wall, just a classic example. Every day somebody get out there and they just chip away and chip away and chip away. And eventually the people sort of just had it crumble. A lot of lives lost and a lot of sadness, a lot of time gone by, but they established what their forefathers set out to do. And I think we just need to do the same. Just enjoy the honeymoon. We're all very, very lucky, very privileged, very blessed people to be in the country we're in and to have the change in legislation. But there's a hell of a lot more work to be done. So please, let's not get complacent.
Well, Paris, thank you so much for being able to join us for this episode of Word for Word. I am absolutely sure there are so many people out there sitting in their cars and listening to this right now that have been enlightened by this story. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Benjamin. Thank you so much for having me here in Joy FM 94.9. Keep it light, keep it bright, and keep it gay.
Word for Word is presented and produced by Benjamin Norris from Australia's LGBTI radio station, Joy. Word for Word is distributed nationally to over 70 radio stations across the community radio network.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.